KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Tacoma-born Dale Chihuly has revolutionized glass art over the past 47 years. Chihulys are dramatic, brightly colored, and often leave the viewer wondering, how could that be done with glass? Chihuly's work is in more than 200 museum collections and countless other buildings around the world. I love when I'm traveling to see a Chihuly. It's a little piece of home, no matter whether I'm in Singapore or London. In 1971, Dale Chihuly co-founded the Pilchuck Glass School in Stanwood. It's become the world's most comprehensive center for glass art education. His major shows include 1995's Chihuly Over Venice, documented in the public TV show, installed in the canals and piazzas of Venice. And in 1999, what he's called his most ambitious exhibition, Chihuly in the Light of Israel. The Chihuly Bridge of Glass is just an amazing 500-foot-long pedestrian overpass that links the Museum of Glass in Tacoma to downtown. And this year at the Seattle Center, the Chihuly Garden and Glass, a permanent exhibit focusing on the artist's career, opened. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So you grew up in Tacoma in the 40s and 50s. What led you to want to become an artist?
Well, I went to the University of Puget Sound the first year. I didn't want to go to college, and my mother twisted my arm, and I went ahead and went. I went to college more or less for her. And that year, I was 17, and I decorated her basement into kind of a club atmosphere. And when I got finished, I thought I was a really good designer. So I transferred to the University of Washington in interior design and architecture.
And then from there, you went to the first glass school in the country, as I understand it.
I'm sorry.
After you graduated from the University of Washington, you went to the first.
Yes. I went to the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Had the first graduate glass program in the country, the first school to teach glassblowing. By that time I was working as a designer for an architect in Seattle, John Graham, who did the Space Needle just before that. But I quit working as a designer, and I went to Alaska and became a commercial fisherman to save money to go to graduate school.
Now, glass art at the time was not what glass art is today, largely because of your influence. What drew you to that medium?
Well, when I was about halfway through the university, I took a weaving course that was a requirement. And I decided at the end of the course to start weaving bits of glass into tapestries. And then I got a little kiln, about 2 feet square, so that I could slump glass and fuse it and put wires into it so that it would be easier to incorporate them into the weavings. And one night I just melted some stained glass between four bricks and put a pipe in there, not a blowpipe, just a regular piece of gas pipe, and gathered it up and blew a bubble. And then from that point on, I wanted to be a glass blower.
I've heard that you attribute your success to your father, but I understand he was a meat packer and a union organizer. How did he play a role in your success?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really sure, but both my father and my mother had a lot to do with my success, I think. My father unfortunately died when I was a junior in high school, and he was a union organizer for the meat cutters, so I was able to get a job at a meatpacking plant when I was in high school, and then worked my way through college.
When did you realize that what you wanted to be was what you could be? I mean, being a glass artist at the time was probably not considered to be an ideal career choice. But at some point along the line, obviously you realized it was not only your passion, but it was also a way you could not only make a living, but a good living.
Well, you know, back in the 60s, If most artists, if they had a choice, would try to get a teaching job at a university, and that would provide you with some income and some of the studios and equipment that you might need. So that's exactly what I did. I went to the University of Wisconsin, and then I went to the Rhode Island School of Design, and then I went to Venice and studied in Venice. But I wanted to, you know, be a professor, and I fortunately I was offered a job at the Rhode Island School of Design. And it was really more than 10 years later, around 1980, that my income from my sales of my glass, which was I think $18,000, and that happened to be the salary that I had was $18,000. So I quit teaching and moved back to Seattle, where myself and some friends had started the Pilchuck Glass School.
And so at that point, you realized I can make a living from doing glass and from teaching.
Yes, that was an opportunity. I could have stayed on. It would have been safer for me to stay on and teach and continue to do my work part-time. But it, my choice was to try to work as an artist full-time. And that's what happened. At first, I traded somebody for a studio, and then I got a little bit of money, and I put the down payment on a 6,000-square-foot building in the south end of Lake Union. And then a few years later, in 1999, I was able to afford to buy the boathouse, which is next to Ivor's Salmon House. And then a little later, I bought a larger building in Ballard. So all the glassblowing takes place in what we call the boathouse, right underneath I-5 on the lake. And then 3 or 4 miles away is the Ballard building. And I build all the sculptures in the Ballard building.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that amazes me about your work is simply the scale. These large works of art done with glass, often very delicate looking, and the size of them, and they're made of glass. I wondered if you got to just the engineering of making them that size fairly quickly, or was there a lot of broken glass along the way?
In 1992, I was given a show at the New Seattle Art Museum, and I was putting in installations, larger sculptures and different objects. And I ended up with a spot in the show that I felt needed something. And I'd been thinking about chandeliers, and I decided to make one for that show. And I didn't know if it would work or not, but I went ahead and built one, and it stayed together. And that was the beginning of many chandeliers. I made about 25 more during the next couple of years, and people were getting kind of anxious because nobody bought one. And but fortunately, eventually somebody bought one. And I don't even quite understand why they don't break each other when they're stacked up the way they do. But somehow the weight on the piece is somehow transferred to what we call the armature. Inside that chandelier, there's some kind of a fabricated metal component that all of the parts are tied onto. And it just, we're very lucky that it just works.
When you're moving these large-scale works, do they have to be disassembled first and taken into pieces and then reassembled at the site?
Yes, they do. And some of them have as much as probably the ones at the Seattle Symphony have 2,000 or 3,000 parts in them. And you take them apart, you pack them, you put them in boxes, you put them in a container, you ship it to the location, wherever it might be, Venice or Spokane, wherever the installation is going. And then my team unpacks them at the site and installs it. So no one ever handles the glass but us.
You had a couple of accidents in the 1970s. You were blinded in your left eye in a car accident. There was a body surfing accident that dislocated your shoulder. How did those accidents affect your work, your ability to work, the way you worked?
Well, the car accident in England was, besides losing the sight of my left eye, was also a very serious accident. And when I got back, I recuperated for about a month in England. And when I got back, I took a semester off. But after that, I started blowing glass again. But it never felt right because I don't have any peripheral vision and I don't have any depth perception. And I always work in a team. Sometimes quite a large can be up to 12 or 14 people. So when you're moving around on the pad, as we call it, and we move quickly, it made other people uncomfortable to work around me because they knew that I couldn't see them. And then when I dislocated my shoulder shortly after that, I didn't have any use of my right arm for several months. And that's when I asked Billy Morris, a great glassblower, who was working with me for about 12 years. I told Billy that he'd have to take over and be what we call the gaffer. The gaffer is the head of the team or the master. And so when I, you know, finally when my arm got better, my shoulder got better, I decided I liked that position of being more or less the director. I could work with larger teams, and I liked, you know, and that's the way I work today.
How did you overcome the lack of depth perception when it came just to conceiving these very three-dimensional works?
You know, I love to photograph my work, and I think somehow the fact that I don't have depth perception in some ways, and I don't really understand how, but I think it makes me understand the photograph better. I can't explain it, but I've often felt that it was no disadvantage in terms of conceiving things. Or I do a lot of drawings and paintings, and having one eye is fine.
I'm talking to the renowned glass artist Dale Chihuly, a Tacoma native, and a Chihuly Garden and Glass that just opened this year down at the Seattle Center. I read a quote from glass artist Benjamin Moore, who has said that you, Dale Chihuly, are the most generous person he's ever known with everything, with your friendship, with your time, with your loyalty. But he also added, but is he difficult? That's putting it mildly, is what he said. You think that's an accurate quotation?
I'll take that.
Yeah?
I can be, you know, I can get on people's case if they're not doing what I want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I vary. Sometimes I'm easy to work with. Other times when it's complicated, I'm more difficult.
Mm-hmm. You've been likened by some to Salvador Dali, to Jeff Koons, to Andy Warhol, not only for the freshness of your artistic vision, but also your showmanship. Do you think showmanship is part of what makes Dale Chihuly art what it is?
Well, I think, I don't know about the showmanship. I do a lot of exhibitions. I've been fortunate to do a lot of museum shows. And I'm more known, not because of my personality, I don't think. I'm better known just for my work and also the videos for PBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Channel 9 video of Chihuly over Venice, really a memorable perspective on your work and your location there.
Yeah, that was the first movie was Chihuly over Venice, and it, I don't know, I can't remember how many stations it played on, but a lot of people saw it, and I was very proud of the fact that I could do that project and have the movie as well, and people to this day still play that on PBS stations.
You mentioned before we got on the air that you'd just been back to Venice for a show, for some of your work there?
No, my wife, Leslie, who's the chairperson for the symphony, took me to lunch on my birthday, September 20th, and as a present, she said, you can go to your favorite city, which happens to be Venice. So we went over. We just went over for 5 or 6 days, and I was going to work for a day or two, but it ended up that it didn't work out. So it was more of a vacation, and it was great to be able to walk around Venice again. And Venice and Jerusalem are my two favorite cities.
You're also an avid collector, and folks who go down to the Chihuly Garden and Glass at the Seattle Center, in the restaurant there's a lot of your collections. There are all these accordions hanging from the ceiling. There's a collection of radios, which, of course, I got a particular kick out of, and shaving brushes and cameras. Is this like the choicest pieces of your collection that are in that restaurant?
Well, the collections that are in the restaurant have to be under 4 inches because that's all the room there is. There's a piece of plate glass over the table, and there's a well in the middle of the table that allows you to have 2 or 3 square feet of objects. And but a lot of my collections wouldn't go in there because they're much bigger than that. But
mm-hmm.
It has some of my favorite collections.
What's your favorite of all of them? Do you have one?
Oh, probably Pendleton blankets. Which would not be in the cafe.
That's an exhibit of that in the actual museum.
There is, yeah. You're right. I forgot about that. There are some shown in the exhibit.
And it's amazing to see them all together like that, too, to see them arranged one next to the other.
Yeah, they're really beautiful.
What is it that when you look forward in your career, probably most of your career is in the rearview mirror, but you're looking forward. What do you see as the things that you would still like to do, still like to accomplish?
Well, you know, for the project, Chihuly project down by the Seattle Center, one of the parts of it is a large glass house that's 44 feet long, high and 112 feet long. And I developed that with Owen Richards, the architect, and I really liked working on that design of that building. So in the future, I would love the opportunity to perhaps work with a glass house again, maybe even something larger.
At this point in your career, are you able to do whatever you want to, or do you still have things on the drawing boards that you have not yet gotten to?
Oh, you know, I'm lucky that I can do a lot of the things that I want to do, but there are certainly ideas I've had that were too difficult to do.
Oh, really?
For one reason or another.
Like what?
Well, I once had an idea that building that's on Lake Union, kind of on the northeast, there's that old steam plant building.
Sure.
What's it called? I can't remember what the company is.
At Gasworks Park, you mean?
No.
Oh, no. The steam plant building they've redone and
yes.
made into offices. But it's still got those
beautiful
steam
windows.
Yeah, those beautiful windows and towers, yeah.
And I wanted to do an installation in there where they would go, the pieces of glass would go all the way up the window. They're about 50 feet high. And you would take a lift that would take you, you get in this lift and it would take you up to look at all the pieces of glass, and then over, and then down, and then up, and over. So you'd experience all of this in the daylight. The light would be beautiful coming through, and at night it would be lit with artificial light. But I worked on trying to do that project, but I lost out on it.
Oh, well, thank goodness you've succeeded in many of the projects that you have done. Dale Chihuly, a great pleasure to have you come by. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Glass artist Dale Chihuly. David Hyde produces our program with Arwin Nix. We got production help from Joshua McNichols. And Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Then you. People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to. And Dale Chihuly doesn't like silence in his studio. In fact, he likes loud music. This is one of the songs that he likes to play while they're working.
Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud. About having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.